And welcome to Conker's Corner. Today I have the privilege and pleasure to speak to Rodney Hobson, the financial author, columnist, speaker and presenter on Share Radio. Good morning, Rodney. How are you?
Good morning. I'm feeling fine.
Listen, Rodney, it was an absolute privilege to meet you on Monday at Gervais's book launch. I was intrigued to have the conversation that we did have about shares and investing. It was great for you to share what you did with us in that little corner that we had.
Indeed, yes. I'm always happy to talk about it.
Excellent, excellent. Now, thank you for coming on to Conker's Corner. I know that there's lots of people out there that know of you and listen to Share Radio, etc. But what I want you to do is just peel it back just a little bit. So for those of the Conker's Corner global audience that are not aware of you, that you can just say, you know, what's your background, where it all started, what your interests were, please?
Yes, my background really was I came from a fairly modest family, and so finance and investment were just not on the agenda at all. So it's completely alien to me, and it's one of the things I say to people, because if I can get into finance and investment, then so can everybody else. But I started life as a journalist, and I came a rather traditional route. I joined my local newspaper as a general news reporter. Then I moved on to a regional morning newspaper, of which there were rather more in those days. Then got into Fleet Street, and I joined the Times, served 7 years as a sub-editor. But in fact, it was only when I went abroad and I went to live in Asia, in Hong Kong and Singapore, it was only then that I actually got into financial journalism. I think it's good to learn the general things, whatever job you're in, and then learn to specialise. So I became deputy business editor of a very, very good magazine, the Financial Economic Review. The Far Eastern Economic Review, I beg your pardon. In Hong Kong. And then I became a business editor of a new newspaper being set up in Singapore called the Singapore Monitor. And at that time, the Singapore was loosening the control of the press, and I thought this was a great opportunity. Alas, after 3 years, things started going backwards again, so my wife and I decided it was time to come home. And I rejoined the Times, and fortunately, vacancy just came up at the right moment for the news editor on business news. I did that for a time, and then I also wrote for the Times as a freelance, and I did stints on the Daily Mail City Desk, a very good city section in the Daily Mail. There's a lot of the newspaper I don't like, but the city section is extremely good, and so I learned a lot there. And the one thing that I did find was that I got phone calls from ordinary people who had acquired shares, either bought them in privatizations, or they'd been given shares because they were members of building societies, they were given shares when the building societies became banks.
Yeah.
And they really didn't know what it was they'd got. They would ring up and say, why have this share price suddenly dropped? And I said to one person, well, have you not read the statement that came from the company? And they said, I knew what the answer was going to be. They said, oh, no, I threw it in the bin because I didn't understand it. So I just felt there must be scope to write a book that explains it all in detail, starting right at the beginning. And that's why I wrote my first book, Shares Made Simple, because it explains what is a share.
Yeah.
So that's about me. So I now write mainly for unsophisticated investors, people who perhaps have never bought shares in their life or have got them and don't know what to do with them. I try to write for them and explain things, because if I can invest, then so can you.
Brilliant, brilliant. That's a great premise. I think it's fantastic that you do that. And that still happens today, unfortunately, you know, with regards to people asking you queries and questions. And, you know, I know you get inundated with people saying, what's happening here? Why, I don't understand what's happened there. And that, you know, I met with Paul Kavanagh and Chris Bailey this week, Financial Orbit, in London, and they were saying that, you know, they do get a lot of questions from ordinary PIs wanting to know what's going on with that stock and this share and the markets and macro and feeling and finding out what's going on with markets, full stop.
Yes, well, let me say, I'm very happy if I'm inundated with queries. I love getting queries from people because I just enjoy helping people. And certainly, if I'm approached on email or if I'm approached on Twitter, I do try to give people full, sensible answers to what they ask. And when I talk in investment shows, I love chatting to people afterwards. So I say to anybody who's listening, if you want to approach me, please do so. The one thing I do ask you is if you get hold of my phone number, please don't ring me up because that's too time consuming. But if you email me or contact me on Twitter, I will let you have as full and sensible response as I can possibly give you. And I'm very approachable. I'm happy to do it.
Yeah, and that was clear to see on Monday night when I met with you and spoke with you, and everybody else was trying to speak with you as well. It was very kindly shared lots of information. Now, Rodney, I wanted to go back just a tad. When you said when you came home, you went back and you went to the Times. When was that about? Was that mid-90s, early 90s?
A little earlier, I'm afraid. I came back at a very exciting time. We returned in the middle of 1985, just before Big Bang. And that was rather scary because a fair amount had already come out about it. It hadn't actually happened. But I was, having been in Asia, I was pretty clueless to what Big Bang actually was, and I had to bluff it through a bit at first. Luckily, I realized nobody else had much idea either.
They
Nobody
didn't,
really.
clearly.
Yeah, nobody knew how this was going to work out. Now, in the event, it worked out extremely well. It has opened up the stock market to a much wider range of people. Then we got the spread of technology and online investing, which is very simple and is very cheap. So the whole stock market did open up. So I think Big Bang was an excellent idea. It's worked extremely well.
Okie dokie. So, with that in mind, then you then went on to do some freelance work, and you were working for the Daily Mail, and that's when you were getting the ordinary individuals making phone calls to yourself and the team at the paper. How was that to start with? Because obviously the next step was the deregulation, wasn't it? Starting there, end of the 80s, beginning of the 90s as well.
Yes, we did start getting deregulation, but it wasn't really about that. It was more about people getting shares in privatizations and from the billing side. It was all about that. One of the curious things about it was that people would ring the Daily Mail City desk about stories they'd seen in the Daily Express. I'm not quite sure why they didn't read the Daily Express. I never found that one out. But they did. I think that they felt that people in the Mail knew what they were talking about.
Oh, I
and
see.
And I have to say, it was a very strong team. The city editor was called Andrew Alexander, and he had a very strong team around him. I was only working there freelance. The staff were very good. And I had, by that time, had a lot of experience of writing financial journalism myself. So I did actually know what I was doing. And yes, so the Mail was great experience, but you did feel, and I enjoyed working there because I did feel we were writing for people who really didn't know what was going on. And you got this situation, for example, you got a lot of takeovers because when the electricity companies were privatized, I'm not sure that any of the electricity companies that came into being then actually still exist. You've got British Gas, at least, is still there. A lot of the building societies have gone. So You got all the people with shares, and things were happening, and people didn't know what to do with their shares. They didn't know how to. And the main thing was they didn't know how to sell them. So one of the problems was they'd have shares, for example, in Northern Rock, and the share price would keep going down, and they'd sit holding them because they had no idea what was happening and what to do with them. And then Northern Rock goes bust, and the shareholders are saying, well, hang on, what's happened to my shares? Why aren't I getting compensation and so forth? Well, if they'd known what was going on, they would have done better.
Exactly, you know, because a lot of them just had the bank accounts and were given the free shares, as you say, and there was no explanation as to what to do, how to do, what to set up,
These people didn't have stockbrokers. Yeah. I mean, then you used to need to have an old-fashioned stockbroker, which meant going round to the office and finding one. Most of them didn't want to handle people with very small accounts.
Indeed.
And people with these privatisation and business society shares would have only one or two companies in their portfolio, and they would have very few shares in each. So stockbrokers didn't want to know you. But we had by the time that the crash in Northern Rock and so forth came round, we had had online stockbroking for a long time, and that is very easy to set up and follow. So people could have done things.
Indeed, they could, and equally, the government could have given them far more information when all this was going on and been allowed to happen as well. You know, so yeah, it's a big learning curve, and hopefully now that won't repeat itself.
Oh, it will. I'm afraid it will. Listen, time is circular. These things will come round again. There's still a lot of people who shut their ears to it. I tried to talk to people and help them, and some people want to be helped. Some people just shut their ears to it. Yeah. But time is circular. It will all come round again. Everything does come round again. And we will perhaps go through a period of greater regulation. Yeah. But the other thing is this. You see, if you're sitting there saying, well, if anything goes wrong, the government will come in and compensate.
Ah, yes.
Then you don't learn anything. It's not in your interest to seek compensation. My advice always is learn your lesson, learn from your mistakes, draw a line under it, move on, do better next time. Don't sit around thinking who's going to compensate me. One of the things that I thought was absolutely outrageous was when people had money in Icelandic banks, which were quite clearly paying high interest rates simply because they were risky. Mm-hmm. When that all collapsed, the government stepped in and compensated people.
Yeah.
They compensated people for moving their money into a foreign country.
Yeah.
Not a good idea. This just encourages people to start looking for compensation, and I say, don't think who's going to compensate me. Think, what is the lesson I should have learned? How can I do better next time? That's the way to go about it.
That's absolutely spot on. I think that may come from our northern upbringing, you know, because I'm brought up in Oldham. You're around the corner at Stockport. And you know, going back to the Iceland thing, there were local government authorities that were putting money into these Icelandic bank accounts, Rodney. Do you remember that?
Yes, indeed.
To the tunes of billions, honestly.
Oh, yeah. These people were supposed to have financial experts in their finance departments.
Yeah.
And it wasn't as if Iceland collapsed suddenly. There were loads of warning signs. Now, a lot of local government outfits put money in on 6 months' deposit.
Yeah.
But you had chance to take the money out because this collapse lasted much more than 6 months before it finally fell off the cliff.
Exactly.
There were tons of warning signs.
It was a slow decline, and then all of a sudden it was just like, you know, like a tsunami, wasn't it? Whoosh,
yes.
At the end, yeah.
Yes, exactly as Northern Rock was. It was coming along. A rail track was another where the government, where it all suddenly fell apart under slightly different circumstances because the government effectively withdrew the subsidy from rail track. But the warning signs were there for quite some time. And that is one of the things why I invest in shares, and because very rarely does a company just collapse at short notice. Woolworths, for example, didn't. Woolworths was in decline for many years before people didn't believe Woolworths could go to the wall. Well, yes, even well-known names can go to the wall. And so you do get this warning. And if you think, well, I'll hang on and I'll get compensated, or who's going to compensate me? Well, you'll never learn your lesson.
Absolutely agree. Absolutely agree. It's brilliant that you took the time out to write, you know, your first book, Shares Made Simple, and hopefully people will take the opportunity to revisit that book and learn, you know, because I think the rules don't change, you know, it's just the companies that change and come and go.
That's absolutely right. I wrote the book in 2007 and I did revise it in 2012. Now, the main point of the revision was actually to give new examples things.
Yeah.
But in fact, very little in basic principles had changed. The main changes had been on the London Stock Exchange. The systems of trading had been much improved, so that was worth recording. And some of the trading didn't affect ordinary investors directly, but you could see how these improvements were. And the other big thing is that the London Stock Exchange has massively improved its website. It's very user-friendly. It used to be very difficult for an ordinary person to use. When I wrote the first edition, by the second edition, it was really easy to use. It's a very good source of information. You've got lots of information on individual stocks and on the markets going back over 5 years. You can find any company you want to research very easily. It's the website that I always go to first.
Ah, excellent. Now you then went on to write the Dividend Investor book, which I think is absolutely essential when investors are looking for growth stocks, but also looking to reinvest the dividends. Now that's an excellent book that you wrote as well.
Yes, indeed. Having got through the basics, I thought, where do we go to next?
Next, exactly.
Now, one of the things, and I'm as guilty of this as everybody else, we all talk about how the FTSE is moving, maybe other indexes are moving. We're always talking about, are your share prices going up or down? And we all tend to lose track of the dividends. Mm-hmm. But over decades, the money you make from dividends is just as big as the money you make from share price rises. And indeed, if you take a period of stagnating stock prices, and after all, we're still below the peak that we reached on the FTSE in the year 2000, if you just think about share prices rises, you've gone nowhere, but the dividends have been pouring in the meantime. And I always say to people, get invested quickly. Don't start dribbling money into the stock market. I think that's a nonsense idea. If you see a share you want to buy, get in, because you might as well start earning dividends straight away. So since 2000, pretty much all your gains have been in dividends. I started investing seriously in 2009. That's when I started constructing a proper portfolio. And since then, I have had gains because shares have moved higher, but most of the gains, even in that period, have come from dividends. And if you want, you can live off the dividends, or you can reinvest the dividends and grow them. So the dividends are absolutely vital. If your share price falls, the dividends give you compensation. If share prices stagnate, you've got gains from the dividends. If share prices rise, you win twice over. But the dividends are vital.
Indeed, I completely agree with that. Now I'm intrigued, Rodney, given that of your expertise and the fact you were doing financial journalism for so many years, why was it, or what was behind the reasoning of not constructing or beginning a serious portfolio until 2009?
There are several reasons. The first one, and perhaps the most important one, was I always say to people, make your own home your first investment.
Ah, right. Now,
because I live in London, of course, house prices are high. It was mercifully I got in before they really shot through the roof. So all my savings went into paying the mortgage.
Ah, okay.
The thing about your house is you've got to live somewhere. Your mortgage will come to an end one day, as mine has.
Yeah.
Your rent goes on forever. But like shares, your house price may go up in value. In fact, almost certainly will go up in value. So you've got the capital gain. But you're also either saving on rent. So you've got a gain there. So you've got an income gain as well. So that was my first thing. The second one was that in the early days, certainly before modern technology, it was difficult to get into shares because it was cumbersome. It wasn't friendly for ordinary retail investors. So I did feel there was a barrier there. Also, there is the fear factor. When you start committing your money to buying shares, it is frightening.
Yeah.
And I had bought some shares in privatizations, but I'd not seriously built up a proper defined portfolio. And in 2009, as the stock market turned, and I was writing about shares, I thought, this is a good time to start getting in for the recovery. And I also felt, if I'm going to write about shares and tell other people how to do it, I really ought to be doing it myself. So I bit the bullet. I set up an online trading account, which is so very easy and is quite cheap. And yes, it was terrifying to make that first choice, but it went through fine. And each time you buy and sell shares, you think, well, it's okay. The world doesn't suddenly come to an end. It isn't a disaster. Just about every share, I've now got about 16 shares in this portfolio, which I built up slowly. Each year I've invested my ISA allowance, and that's how I do it. So it's properly constructed. And all the shares, I think, in the 16 I've got there, have been showing a loss at some stage, though mercifully not all at the same time.
Yeah.
But over the years, apart from having all those dividends coming in, the value of my shares is higher now than when I bought them. Most of them are ahead. I've got one or two losses. Everybody makes mistakes. Don't expect to buy shares and think they're all going to move higher. They won't. Some will fall. We all get it wrong. But as long as you balance it out and are reasonable and you're patient, if you make a mistake, don't be afraid to take a loss and get out, but don't panic. You can see yourself through the ups and the downs, and I'm quite happy with that portfolio. Yes, I now wish I'd done it sooner, and that's one of the reasons why I encourage people to buy shares. Get in now. Mm-hmm. You'll regret not doing it sooner.
Indeed, for the long term. I mean, the great thing about it is, given that the fact you're watching, writing, and advising people via your columns and your articles that you've written prior to 2009, is that uncannily, and I'm not sure if it's the first time look or whatever, was that you saw that recovery starting in 2009, and the market, say the FTSE, if you use them for example, was nearer to 3,500 then. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yes. We had a nasty shock.
Exactly. Yeah. And now we're nearer to 7,000. So the market's nearly doubled in spite of all the panics and crashes and, noise and all the different, more recently Brexit. We're nearer to 7,000. The market's doubled. You've had your 16 stocks. You've gone in. You've collected all of those lovely dividends as well, which I will make the assumption that you've compounded some of that and reinvested most of that as well. So that's fantastic.
I reinvest all of it now. I mean, my first aim was to set up a portfolio and draw out the dividends.
Yeah.
But then as I got more into it, I thought, no, leave the dividends in so they remain within the ISA, so they remain tax-free and reinvest them. And if you do reinvest, and if you are in the position that you don't need the income and you can reinvest, your portfolio starts to snowball. It's
exactly.
To really start to grow much more. So, yes, I mean, the early stocks that I bought, and I think the ISA allowance from memory was about £7,000 in 2009. So I did that. Of course, it's now up to over £15,000. I invest the full amount of the ISA each year. So I haven't held them all, of course, over that period. The early ones have really taken off. Mm-hmm. Some of the later ones are currently showing a loss, but I'm very happy with them. Mm. I mean, for example, I bought W.H. Smith fairly recently.
Yeah.
That is showing a loss. I think that's wrong. I think it's a very good company and will pick up again. So I'm holding on. I've had dividends in the meantime.
Yeah.
So, yes, I roll it up. And, yes, the account starts to snowball. And now I find that if I build up, say, £1,000 in dividends, I reinvest that when I've aggregated it.
Yeah.
But what I do is, I know you can have schemes where you can take a scrip dividend, that is, you take dividend in shares rather than cash, mm-hmm. or you can tell your broker to automatically reinvest the dividend in the same shares of the same company. I don't do that because I want control of it. So I collect the cash. When I've got a decent amount, I then make my choice of what I'm investing in.
Ah. Right. Okay. That's an interesting technique, but it works for you, and that's what matters. You've refined your strategy over the last 20 years, which is great, isn't it?
Indeed. That's it. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm refined all the time.
Yes, it is a good idea to keep thinking about it, and think about what you want to do. And I have changed my attitude. I did, for example, want to go originally for dividend payers. I then later decided I'd invest in one or two companies that weren't paying a dividend. For example, Barrett Development, when I invested around about 2010, I think it was.
Yeah.
They weren't actually paying a dividend, but I was confident they would start to do so. So I was able to get into the shares fairly cheaply. In fact, they fell by about a third of their value after I bought, and that was certainly started to panic at that stage.
Yeah.
But they came back. They're now worth five times what I paid for
them. Brilliant.
So I started looking at that. But what I always say to people is, when you start off, go for something dull, something boring, something very solid. You're not looking to get rich overnight. If you want to be rich overnight, buy a lottery ticket. this is about if you're talking about genuine investing, you're talking about long term. Go into companies that you know, that you're comfortable with, that you understand, companies that make profits and pay dividends, and enjoy that and start it rolling it up. And then you, as you get the hang of it and you get more experience and you get more into it, then you can start doing other things and you may start taking risks. I've taken one or two risky shares I would not have bought at the start,
yeah,
because I've now got a showing a profit, so I now feel I can take a risk, and if I lose something, well, my portfolio is still ahead.
Yeah, it's that adage really about starting slowly and then growing your portfolio, to reiterate what you've said. And then when you've got a certain size of portfolio, you can have that element of risk as a very, very, very small percentage of your portfolio to increase the diversity of your portfolio. But if you start with all of your investments in, for instance, AIM and tiny little microcap stocks, then you're in a hiding to nothing because all of your portfolio is at risk.
Yes, I absolutely agree. The thing is, you can buy 10 risky stocks, and if one of them actually zooms away, it covers for the 9 that went bust
or never
got anywhere.
Yeah.
You can't do that, but it is extremely risky. Yeah. If you, in fact, pick 10 duds, then you're losing money. So, yes, you shouldn't do risky investments with money that you can't afford
to lose.
To lose.
Absolutely.
And I still err on the side of caution. Yeah. I'm very reluctant to take even a moderate risk. I'm very much low risk.
Yeah.
I'm low risk, I'm cautious, I'm long term. That's my strategy. Mm. But as you mentioned a moment ago, and it's something I would say to people, if it works for you, go with it and good luck to it, just as long as you know what you're doing.
Exactly. Now, touching on your portfolio, looking at it as 100%, okay, with regards to what's in it, what's the breakdown regarding FTSE, overseas, blue chip funds, etc.? How's it broken down, your portfolio, Rodney, please?
Right. My portfolio is 100% UK.
Yeah.
It's what I know and understand.
Yeah.
And it's about 90% FTSE 100 stocks. It would have been 100% FTSE 100, I think, but one or two companies have dropped out of the. The one I did, and it didn't work out very well, was Hornby, which has now moved down to AIM. It's the only AIM stock I've got.
Okay.
It's a very small investment. I decided to stick with it. I've got some large mid caps, I would think, but certainly I'm heavily into blue chips in the UK. I don't invest abroad, A, because I think there's quite enough selection here. And if you start investing in foreign companies, perfectly all right to invest in New York, for example, as long as you've got a reputable stock exchange. But you then start introducing a foreign exchange risk.
Yeah.
Now, those who've been holding American stocks have done very well since Brexit because of the fall of the pound, so the value of their stocks in dollars has rather gone up.
Yeah.
But it is a risk. For a long time before Brexit, the pound was actually overvalued, and people who'd bought shares in with US dollars were finding they didn't translate into so many pounds. So you do introduce a new element of risk. If you are investing in New York, possibly Frankfurt would be okay, or Paris, as long as it's well-regulated, it's okay, as long as you understand there is that extra risk that if the pound rises in value, your foreign holdings fall short. And at the moment, for example, where the pound has been very depressed after Brexit, if you believe that it's hit the bottom and may come rise again, this isn't a good time to be buying foreign shares. I don't want to add that extra risk of the foreign exchange markets into my portfolio. Now, the other thing I don't do is I don't invest through funds. There's nothing wrong with going through funds. And if you're too scared or feel too ignorant to be able to invest in shares yourself, it's perfectly fine to go through a fund. I'd rather invest in a fund than not invest at all. A fund will do better than leaving the money in the your bank.
Or business.
Yeah,
agreed.
It will do better. So that's fine. But to me, because it is so easy to trade now, and because there is all the information is out there, and all the information is out there quickly, the professionals don't have the great advantage they always used to have. Because it's so easy to do it yourself, and you can do it yourself, why not do it yourself? Why pay a fund manager to do it for you? Because the problem with funds is the manager has to be paid. If it's an active fund, then you've got the churn of the stocks, which costs money. So that has all got to be done before the fund manager catches you up. So yep. The fund managers have got to do noticeably better than you. Now, if you find a good fund manager and do it, that's fine. The other problem with funds, from my mind, is that a fund's doing really well this year. So you think, well, I'll put my money in that. Next year, it doesn't do so well. Funds have a habit of doing well in some years and then badly the next ones. Very few funds will have a good consistent performance, because if they do have a good persistent performance, people will have bought in, and either the units or the shares, depending on whether it's investment trust or a unit trust, these will have been pushed higher. So the value of the fund will be reflected in those prices getting in. So to me, there's no magic wand in going with a fund, but better than leaving it in the bank account.
No, I would agree with that. I mean, they do have their I spoke with Annabelle Brody Smith a little while back, and she works for the AIC, and we were talking lovely lady, and we were talking about the dividend heroes, which have pooled and you know, smoothed out their dividends over the years, and there's some exceptional funds there, but like you say, it's one of those things where everyone has to find their strategy. You found yours, and you've opted not to choose funds. But
Please don't turn on about what I said about funds. One thing I would just add is that it is useful with funds, because you look at their name and you can tell whether they're into accumulating the money or whether they're into paying a dividend. Yeah. You can tell whether they're into small companies or large companies. Yeah. Funds are very good if you want to invest overseas in markets that you don't understand. Is a good way of getting into foreign markets. Yeah. That's where it's happening. So you can pick a fund that suits you. That is one of the great things
Absolutely. Now, I wanted to just go back just a tad, Rodney, because I know you say you've got 90% of your portfolios in the FTSE 100 and large to mid caps. What is your criteria when you're picking those stocks? Because obviously you've got your own selection process. What is it that you're looking for?
Right. Well, I'm a bottom-up investor.
Yeah.
I read company results as they come out, and I look for companies that catch my eye. If I feel that the shares are undervalued, that it's a solid company, that it's making profits, that the market hasn't really cottoned on to it, that's the sort of company that I look for. I don't sort of think I want a particular sector. I think the company itself is what is important. There are winners and losers in every sector.
Absolutely.
So coming from the top down, saying, oh, I want to invest in a company that trades in a certain country, a geographical area, and then going down to a sector and then picking a company within that sector, to me, is entirely the wrong way around. What is it? What you are buying into is not a sector. You are buying shares in a company. So why not start with the company? Look for a company you like. Now, it may well be that if you then see the sector and the sector's doing badly, for example, you might feel, I shop at Sainsbury's every week, perhaps I should buy shares in Sainsbury. It seems quite busy. Then you look at, by all means, look at the sector, supermarkets, price wars at each other's throat. Nobody's quite sure where it's going. Profits are going to be crushed, you may feel. So, yes, you look at the sector and think, oh, well, maybe I won't go with it. But you don't look at the sector first. To me, you go for the company, and that's what I always go for.
No, that's very, very interesting criteria there. Now, you touched on as well that you, when you first started, you were looking for dividend payers, and now you're not as focused on that. But are you looking at the balance sheet and the levels of debts as well?
I do look at levels of debt, certainly. If I feel a company is badly overstretched, I've been saying for many years now, as many other people have been, that interest rates will rise someday. Well, they will. And I do feel that there's so much debt around, this government debt, this personal debt, this company debt. I don't know how it's all going to be paid when interest rates rise, as they inevitably will do. We've already seen one rise in the United States and the Fed rate, and probably getting another one soon. So interest rates will start to rise, and companies that are badly stretched will be hard pushed to do it.
Yeah.
So yes, I do look at debt, and I look at how well the interest rate is covered. And one thing I would just mention, I always scorn any company that gives you the EBITDA figure. This earnings before interest, tax, depreciation, amortization. Yeah. Before tax, fine. You cannot take earnings before interest payments, because interest payments have to be made. Yeah. That figure is worthless. So what I look for is pre-tax profits, profits that are come through after the interest has been paid. Because you could have a company that's actually sinking in debt, but is actually making a small profit before it pays the interest.
Yeah.
If the profit doesn't cover the interest, then that's no use. So, debt certainly I don't like. But on the whole, I'm looking for companies that increase their sales each year, increase their profits each year, which is more important still, and companies that increase their dividend each year. It doesn't matter if there's a bit of a blip, as long as the five-year trend is pretty reasonable. The sales figure, if it falls, then there may still be a good reason for it. For example, WH Smith has seen sales fall but profits rise, simply because it's shut down a lot of non-performing branches. So if there's a good reason for it, that's fine. The profit figure is the more important figure. I do look at the yield, whether there is a reasonable yield. On average, I would expect companies to be paying something like 3.5 to 4%. I try to go for any company yielding more than 4. If it's yielding more than 6, I start getting nervous, because if the shares don't rise, then it may be the market's fearing the interest rate will get cut. So I do look at that. The other ratio I would suggest people look at is the price-earnings ratio. It tends to be about 13 or 14. The lower the ratio, the cheaper the shares are in theory. But if the ratio gets below 10, again, I start to get nervous and think, does the market see something I don't see? Are these shares cheap for a good reason?
Indeed.
And I would be very nervous of buying anything with a ratio of more than 20, unless I felt there was something really compelling. So the things I look for are profits, dividend, and if you want a ratio, dividend yield and price earnings. I know a lot of people go into ratios, and you could write a whole book on it. In fact, a chap called Robert Leach has written a whole book on ratios, and it's published by Harriman House, who published my books. If you want to go into it, fine. But I think that most people, particularly less sophisticated investors, don't want to go into all these complex calculations. You'll be doing them for so long, you'll miss your chance to invest.
That's a very good point.
Yes. I mean, I did have a conversation with someone who followed me on Twitter, and we did have this conversation, and I realized this chap never invested, because he was analyzing to such a great extent that by the time he decided to buy, the share price had moved. So he had to calculate it all over again. No one who never invested. So don't take it so seriously. The two you want are dividend yield and price earnings ratio. Those are the two key ones. It is also worth looking at dividend cover.
Dividend cover, of course. I'm going to get onto that,
How well is the dividend covered? Because if the dividend cover is less than one, then some of the dividends are being paid out of reserves.
Out of profits, yeah.
I do say what you're looking for as a general rule, the dividend cover of 2. I don't mind 1.5, and I don't mind some years where it dips. as long as it's not, if it's creeping down all the time, the dividend cover, then I get nervous.
No, that's a very, very good point. I'm always looking for a dividend cover of two when I'm looking for my dividend stocks. And I'm also looking at what their return on investments are. So what are they actually getting back in return for spending the CapEx?
Yes, it's perfectly reasonable to look at that. I confess I don't. I think that starts getting beyond what most people can comprehend.
Okay.
So, yes, if you find it helpful, yes, by all means, and certainly any investor, if you find looking at ratios does help you, yeah, that's fine.
But yeah.
If you're not too great on maths, the thing about the PE and the dividend yield, you can find it quite easily on the internet.
Yeah.
And in fact, there are some, the dividend cover you can easily work out, and there's some of the ratios that are there in the company's announcement.
Yeah.
So, yes.
But I mean, saying that, I mean, with all the ratios and that, you do now do a column for Morningstar on a regular basis, and you're on Share Radio weekly. So lots of that information is like you say, now all of it's very, very accessible. Whereas when you started in the 80s, it wasn't, was it? You know,
that's right. Yes, back in the 80s, you didn't have all this information. And what's more, the stock market announcements were actually posted up on a board in the stock exchange before we had technology. Could you put it? So all the professionals go in and see all the announcements, and they're well away before anybody else can deal. So the ordinary investors are left behind. Now, if you go into the stock market website, if you want to get up at 7 o'clock in the morning, you can look at all the announcements, nearly all the major announcements that matter, and certainly all the company results, come out at 7 o'clock. You can read through them, and you're as clued up as any professional at 8 o'clock. And there is a lot of information in these statements. So, yes, you can invest with the professionals now. It has made a tremendous difference.
No, I think that's one of the beauties of it. The other downside, though, Rodney, and I've touched on this with other people, is that we've almost got too much information, and it creates a lot more noise. So people, which I'm trying to encourage, you're trying to encourage people to be long-term investors, but they end up churning because they hear that noise, they hear that reaction, and they go, Brexit, Trump. And they're in and out in the morning, and in the afternoon they're going, oh, it wasn't that serious. And then thinking, now, do I buy the stock back? But now I'm going to pay more for what I sold it.
Yes, indeed. Ask yourself if you're a long-term investor or not. Now, the market does actually move quite erratically. One of the reasons is that we now get computer trading and computer program. You get all this. And that worries some people. I'm absolutely delighted by it because it creates such opportunities. If you look at a graph of the FTSE 100 index, for example, over 12 months, certainly over 3 years, you'll see, although it moves erratically, it actually goes sideways for a lot of time. So if you buy every time the market dips, then and sell when it hits the top, it's not a bad policy. The computers are giving us a much better chance to get in. Bear this in mind. First of all, computers panic. Computers panic. And that gives you an opportunity because you as a human being don't have to panic. And so what happens is that the computers sell shares because they think they've peaked, and then some other computer comes in after it, and then another computer panics because the share price is falling, and they pile in one after the other. And so it drives the share price, which is very low. And then suddenly one computer says, oh, these shares are cheap, I'm buying in.
Yeah.
And gradually it turns the corner and you get the same computer panic going back up again. But remember also this, it's now reckoned that possibly at least 40%, and it's probably more now because I'm taking a figure from 2 or 3 years back, possibly more than half of all share trades now are between two computers. One computer saying buy and one computer saying sell. So what makes you think the computer's got it right? One of them got it wrong.
Indeed. Unfortunately, the situation is with some large corporates, and I'll say US corporates, Rodney, is that they're working for the same company, on one's on the buy side and one's on the sell side, which is absolutely phenomenal.
Yes, indeed. And it may be what the client wants. But there's no use thinking I can't beat the computer. Yes, you can beat the computer.
Agreed.
You see, Nika? So that doesn't worry me, and it creates buying opportunities. It is difficult when you're a new investor to see share prices rise and fall erratically. It does make you very nervous. The more of these swings you live through, the less you get worried about it, because you understand. And also, as you build up your your portfolio, it's worth more. So then you can stand a short-term loss. If you are into long-term investing, then don't worry about things like stop losses. You're not here to make up your loss in a day. A day trader who buys in the morning and then sees the price fall has got to get out. He's only got 4 or 5 hours to make that money back again. If you're a long-term investor and you see your share price fall, you've got 4 or 5 years to make that back again. It's a completely different time frame. So you can actually stand the short-term losses if you're in for the long term.
Absolutely agree. Absolutely agree. And I think also that one thing to remember here for investors is that they have to think about the portfolio as a portfolio and not that one stock that's generated that news that day. So look at the percentage of your portfolio that's moved at the end of the week or the end of the month, and not how that one individual stock has been impacted by whatever piece of news.
Yeah, yes, you're quite right. One of the things also to remember is, because most of this sort of news will come out at 7 o'clock, as soon as the market opens at 8 o'clock, says bad news, the shares fall immediately. Yeah. Right, you've missed the best chance to get out, because they've already fallen. Yeah. So there is no point in panicking now. Now, it's perfectly reasonable to look at it and think, are they going to keep on falling, in which case I'll bite the bullet and take the loss. But if you feel all the bad news is in that share price fall and the shares will come back over time, then there's no point in selling at that stage. And certainly, yes, shares that fall heavily at 8 o'clock can bounce back. As we saw with Brexit, the index... When it opened at 8 o'clock, dropped 500 points. By the end of that day, the loss was only 200 points. 300 points, most of that loss had actually made up within the day. And as we all know, in fact, within a few days, the index was back where it had been before. And now it's even further ahead.
Yeah, exactly.
So yes, a lot of bad news gets into the share price right at the start of trading. So don't panic. Think sensibly.
Great advice there, Rodney. Thank you. Now, what has been the greatest lesson you've attained, Rodney, since you started investing seriously?
Should have done it sooner.
Right.
That's one of the things. Yes. Should have done it sooner. I mean, there's not great immediate riches, as we've said already. But investing in the stock exchange, if you've got any money, it is by far the best investment you can get. It gives you the chance to make capital gains. It gives you a chance to gain income. It also gives you the chance to build up slowly and actually pay in comparatively small amounts.
Yeah.
Now, the only comparable advantage or investment you could make is in property. And yes, if you buy to let, yes, all right, you buy a building, buy a house, it goes up in value over time and you get rental income. But the tax regime is getting worse for buy to let, and also you can't dribble in small amounts. You've got to buy a whole building, or at least a whole flat. You can't buy it a brick at a time. So it's a very cumbersome way. And also, if you want to get out, it's very difficult to get out quickly, because it takes time to find a buyer and go through all the process and so forth. With shares, you can get out that day. You can get out that moment.
Yeah.
So shares do give you that advantage of coming out. It is by far the best investment. And when people talk about gold or the dollar as having been a safe haven, I think that's absolute rubbish. To me, the safest investment, and every investment carries some risk, the safest investment is in shares. I should have done it sooner. So if you're sitting there thinking, dare I, get on with it. Don't make my mistake.
Great advice. Now, what has been your wisest investment decision to date, Rodney?
I think it turned out, well, it has to be Barratt Development, because I did learn a lot from it as well. I bought in at a time when I felt the shares would turn. I mentioned it earlier in the podcast. I think that was the best one. It has certainly made the most money, and I did learn the lesson of holding your nerve, of actually reasoning out whether it's a good investment or not, and looking at all the points that matter. Mm-hmm. So that I learned most from, and it has been by far my best investment. And as I say, it lost money at the start. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm very happy about that one.
Yeah, it's that thing about having patience and sticking by your conviction, isn't it? You know.
Yes, it is. You don't be foolhardy. I mean, most of us refuse to believe we've made a mistake. And one of the mistakes that most people make and most professionals make, if you got it wrong, I'm afraid you do have to face up to it. Most of us refuse to accept we got it wrong and stick with the shares when they keep falling. And I made that mistake with Hornby. They've now reached the point where they have bottomed out and there's no point in selling. Mm-hmm. But I made that mistake. I stuck with it. Never stick with shares just because you like the sound of them or there's some sort of sentimental or anything like that. Do face reality. And if things are seriously going wrong or there's no sign things are going to get better, you might as well get out. And yes, take a loss. None of us like to sell at a loss, but do be prepared to take a loss. So that's one of the most important lessons to learn.
I would reiterate that as well, because I mean, only this week the FCA came out and launched a broadside to all CFD and binary betting companies, and I was holding CMXCX, which is CMC stock, and I was planning to hold that for 2 to 5 years, and it was going to be a little baby IGG and grow. Yeah. And I was like, oh, that's not good news. That's going to impact them for the next 2 or 3 years. I'm going to have to get out, and I have to take a massive, I think it's 45% loss on it. And I thought, right, okay, just move on. But it was hard to do, but I had to force myself to do it. And then I had to take the loss and just get out and just start reassessing what's going on.
You're a very brave man, and you're absolutely right. And most people wouldn't stand a 45% loss. They'd think, oh, well, it's all happened, so I'll stay with it. But it's better to take a 45% loss than a 90% loss when all said and done. So well done, I say.
No, you've got. I mean, this is part of the process. I mean, I said, because I coach and mentor some people via Twitter and other avenues, and I say, look, if you can't be gracious when your stocks are going up and you get a takeover at 50% premium or whatever, you've got to be able to be gracious with that, and also take the grace when something goes wrong or a profit warning or an event happens where your stock goes down dramatically. Take the good with the bad, because that's the whole point of the process. You're never going to have a portfolio without any losers.
Oh, I think that is very good advice. Yes, you've got to take the rough with the smooth. Quite so. And yes, I think I mentioned earlier, I've got 16 stocks. They've all been down at some stage, and some of them are showing a loss, although some of those losses have been already covered by the dividends I've received. But yes, there's... At any time, you're likely to have some shares showing a loss. It does happen. You don't win it straight off every time.
No, it goes with the territory. Now, given the many lessons that you've learned since you started investing, Rodney, which one, other than ones you've shared already, would you like to share with our audience, please?
Be patient.
Yeah.
Yes, don't lose your nerve. Do trade through the good and bad times. Yes, I think patience is it. And one of the things is, don't get obsessed with your portfolio. I know some people sort of sit and pore over the computer all evening after doing a day's work. I think that's no fun. The one thing I have learned is that investing should be fun, and you should enjoy it, and you should enjoy making money, which I hope you will do. But if you reach the point where it just becomes an obsession and it takes over your life and you don't have a home life and you can't sleep at night, it isn't worth it. That isn't worth it. If you really can't sleep at night, don't do it. So that's the thing. Don't let it take over your life.
That's great advice. And I think that you're touching on there that it should be fun, in a sense of you shouldn't have high risk stocks that are going to keep you up at night. You know, you should have something that you can relax and not have to watch and go on holiday and be assured that the company's still going to be in existence.
That's right. I mean, if you enjoy wheeler dealing, if you enjoy the cut and thrust of it, and yet by all means do it. Most of us probably don't. I mean, yes, it can be great fun, but only do what you enjoy doing.
Yeah, excellent. Now, if there was one thing you could change, Rodney, regarding the investing landscape, what would that be?
I'm not sure I would change anything. No, I think the investment landscape has changed so much for the better, particularly in terms of buying shares. It's just all the changes I would like to see, which is more information readily available to ordinary investors, cheaper ways of buying and selling shares, instant access to the stock exchange, instant access to information. All these things have become part of our everyday life. All the big changes I wanted to see have now happened. I don't see anything that stands in the way of ordinary people investing. And indeed, it is one of the reasons, as I say, why I went into serious investing and seriously building a portfolio in 2009, because I felt that the whole landscape was so much better and so much friendlier to ordinary investors. And the message always remains, if I can do it, you can do it.
No, that's brilliant advice there. And I wanted to, just before we close, Rodney, I wanted to touch on the fact that, yes, you are in large caps, but you also have written a wonderful book called Small Companies, Big Profits. And I just wanted to, you, if you could quickly, just as very succinctly as possible, just give a few little criteria and points of the book regarding how to pick those particular smaller companies that eventually might come out and become like the little mini ASOSes and Acorn to ARM sort of companies.
Yes, indeed. Well, you're looking at riskier stocks. As companies are small, they tend to be, and this is particularly true if you're buying stocks on AIM, they are riskier. A lot of AIM stocks don't make profits, and even some of those that do make profits don't actually pay a dividend. So it is harder. However, it is quite clear that if you hit on a small company that is a winner, then it really can take off. You can make a lot of money. And the example I always give is Domino's Pizza. You'll see, you see on the domino, there are three dots on the domino. They started with three outlets and they grew enormously. If you got in on that name, it is great, as long as you understand it is more risk. So you are looking more carefully. I think you need to do more research into smaller companies. You look more carefully at what it is they do. One of the best things you can look for is what is going to be tomorrow's success story. So particularly in this technological age, if you can see some company that has a real niche, that produces something that other people don't do, that's got a great idea that starts to take off, then you can pick up that kind of company. I would always say make it a small part of your portfolio so that if it doesn't work as well as you expected, you can stand the loss. But I think that certainly for smaller companies, you need more research. You most certainly need to go back over 5 years if you can. The problem with a lot of AIM companies is they don't have that five-year track record. So you are taking a lot on trust. But yes, you need to look at, what is it they're offering? Is there really a demand for what it is? Have they really got it to themselves? The problem for smaller companies, of course, is the large ones that you've got a good idea and muscle in and they've got the firepower to do it. So, yes, smaller companies, make it a smaller part of your portfolio unless you find you do really well. Do be more careful. Do research them rather more extensively than you would to do with a larger company.
No, that's brilliant synopsis there. Thank you ever so much for that, Rodney. That's very kind of you. Now, I've covered all my questions, Rodney. I didn't know if there's any books, obviously excluding your own, that you would like to share with our listeners to say, look, this is a book regarding investing that I would recommend if you're starting out. Is there one out there that you would recommend?
Well, one very popular one is The Naked Trader. Yeah. I think that's a very good book. I did mention Robert Leach's books on ratios. Yeah. If you feel that is what you want to go for, my books are published by Harriman House. I would suggest that anybody interested in investing goes onto the Harriman House website and looks through and sees what sort of books are available and see if there's something that really addresses the sort of issues that you want. It's a very good site. Harriman's publication is nearly all investment or finance or money, that kind of thing. And there's a very good selection there. New books are coming through. I would make that the site to go to. Yeah. They're the biggest publisher of investment books in this country. So that's the place to go.
Okay, that's fantastic advice there. I'm sorry, Ronnie, we've run out of time here because I was going to touch on your crime writing books as well, but we may have to do that another time, unfortunately.
They're only a hobby. They are all fiction, but some people say the finance books are fiction as well.
Well, I mean, you've just written a book about scams as well, haven't you? The frauds that's going on regarding personal identity and all the rest of it.
Yes, indeed. We all get these calls from scammers, and so many people fall for them. And despite the publicity, people keep falling for them. So I've tried to write the book of scams to advise people on how to spot a scam and how to avoid it. So I think that I heartily commend to anybody, whether you're thinking of investing or not.
No, that's very, very good of you to have done that. But I think actually I will ask one more question. Given your length of time in journalism and the finance world, if you're looking at a company, I'll rephrase it. What are you looking for with regards to leadership? When I'm talking about the individual leadership now, I'm talking about the CEO and CFO, Rodney.
Yes, I do look to see whether a company's fortunes have picked up with a particular chief executive, certainly. On the whole, I don't worry too much about the chief executive because the proof is of the pudding is in the eating. If the results coming through are fine, then that does, it shows that the management's good. There have been one or two individuals who've stood out. Kate Swan, who completely transformed W.H. Smith.
Indeed.
Terrific leader. And it's always doubtful when she goes. I think that her replacement there has done quite well with W.H. Smith, so I'm not worried there. And Justin King at Sainsbury completely transformed it. So you just occasionally get a real leader who really stands out. And if one of those decides to quit and move on to another job, then it is always worth looking at, will the company carry on well without him? Certainly, Sainsbury's hasn't done anything like as well since Justin King left. So it is a criterion. But on the whole, to me, I don't look so much at the management. If I see a director who's been part of a complete disaster somewhere else, that would certainly scare me off. I wouldn't do it. But as I say, in the end, if it's good management, it comes through in the results. This is results that matter far more.
No, that's brilliant. Now, I want to thank you once again, Rodney, for sharing your time. I look forward to meeting you again in London at some point or other, maybe at another book launch or maybe when we do an event. I'd like to ask you at this point, Rodney, is that in 2017, we're going to be doing some shows in and around the country, and I'd like at some point to invite you to one of those to give a small talk, if possible, about investing for the benefit of our audience. Would that be possible?
That's certainly possible. I'm always happy to meet people, and as I said earlier in the show, if the people there want to come and talk to me afterwards and ask me questions or guidance, I'm very happy to do so. The only thing I can't do is give individual personal financial advice.
Of course.
As long as they understand that, as general pointers and general and information, I'm very happy to talk to people.
That's very, very kind of you, Rodney. I appreciate that. Now, that was Rodney Hobson, the financial journalist, author, presenter. You can find Rodney regularly on Share Radio, and he's got a weekly column on Morningstar. Rodney, thank you ever so much, chap. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you, and speak soon.